I'm Louise Steinman, curator of Aloud, a series of dynamic lectures, readings, performances, and discussions that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic Downtown Central Library in the heart of Los Angeles. You're about to hear Robert Alter discuss his new translation of the timeless Book of Psalms with author Jonathan Kirsch and LA Times Book Review editor David L. Ulin. This program was originally presented on September 17, 2007. For more information on Aloud, please go to our website, www.aloudla.org.
I'm very happy to be here and to be part of this very congenial panel. I'd like to frame the discussion to which I'm looking forward by taking just a few minutes to talk about the poetry of Psalms and why I decided to attempt my own translation. And I will read just three psalms to give you a sense of what it sounds like in my English version. Now, I suppose you have to have a lot of chutzpah to translate psalms, because psalms is obviously one of the most cherished books of the Bible, and it's the one book of the Bible written in poetry that everybody knows is poetry, even though, as you're probably aware, in the King James Version, it's not laid out typographically as verse. Yet there are all these indications that the Psalms are sung. Not all of them were sung. There are notations of musical instruments, musical modes, and so forth. And for a long time, certainly from the Renaissance on, the Book of Psalms was valued as a kind of touchstone of what poetry was all about, so that many British poets from the mid-16th century, I would say, till the turn of the 18th century, cut their teeth on doing English versions of Psalms without benefit, except for the case of Milton, with knowledge of the original Hebrew, but they turned it into various English verse forms. So why do we need a new one? As beautiful as some of the versions of Psalms, and of course particularly the King James Version is, they are, to my ear, as someone who has been reading these poems in Hebrew since adolescence, very far from the originals. Part of it has to do with a lack of precision of vocabulary, and in particular with taking a set of terms that in the Hebrew have very concrete, even physical meanings, and transposing them into a theological register, which is by no means part of the biblical mindset or the biblical worldview. To cite just one instance, which I will not belabor this, in my translation, alas, there is no salvation. I hope that this won't throw any of you into utter despair. The problem is that this Hebrew word, Yeshua, does not mean salvation with all its implications of flights of angels and sitting at the right hand of God and so forth, but it is a very plain here and now term that means getting out of a tight fix. And so, in my translation, I'm sure to the dismay of some readers, the God of my salvation becomes the God of my rescue. And this is something which is a thread that runs through a lot of my translation choices. But even more than the vocabulary, I had a problem with the music, or the lack of music, of the existing translations. Poetry is a kind of music, even when it's not accompanied by instruments. And the rhythms of the Hebrew are very compact, very powerful. And for me, much of the emotional meaning of these poems comes through these rhythms. And so I went about inventing strategies for tamping down the English language, which is very different structurally from biblical Hebrew. In biblical Hebrew, you can say something in two words or three words that takes seven or eight words in English, which is a translator's nightmare. So I did things like choosing words of Anglo-Saxon derivation, which were monosyllabic, rather than words like iniquity, which had three or four syllables, crime instead of iniquity, and so forth. I also left out the verb to be where it wasn't strictly necessary, and I made certain attempts even to emulate in English, I wouldn't say reproduce, but to emulate in English other musical sound patterns like alliteration and assonance. It does not work equally well in all verses, in all psalms and in all lines of the psalms, I can assure you, but I have a sense that it might be a better approximation of the Hebrew than what we've had up till now. Okay, with this, I'll just give you one example, and then I'm going to read the whole psalm from which this example is taken. In Psalm 30, which is a Thanksgiving psalm, there's a line which in the King James Version reads as follows. What profit is there in my blood when I go down to the pit? Now, to my ear as a reader of poetry, this is not poetry. With all due respect to the eloquence of the King James Version, it loses rhythm entirely in the second half of the line. And even in the first half, it has at least two or three syllables too many. What profit is there in my blood? Which in the Hebrew sounds like this, ma betza bidami. And so I translated this line, what profit in my blood, in my going down deathward, which more or less replicates the rhythm of the Hebrew line. Now, I'll recite the whole Hebrew line for you. Ma betza bidami briditi shachat. Also, you notice that there's an alliteration in my translation, in my going down deathward, which isn't in the Hebrew. Now, this is a little translator's trick. It's not in the Hebrew, but in the first half of the line, there's a very strong alliteration, which I could not reproduce. Ma betza bidami, where you have both the B sound and the D sound repeated. So I compensated in the second half for what I couldn't do in the first half. Translators are tricky people, and there's a fundamental dishonesty in the activity. Okay, let me read this one. Psalm, song for the dedication of the house for David. I shall exalt you, Lord, for you drew me up, and you gave no joy to my enemies. Lord, my God, I cried to you, and you healed me. Lord, you brought me up from Sheol, gave me life from those gone down to the pit. Hymn to the Lord, O his faithful, acclaim his holy name, but a moment in his wrath, life in his pleasure. At evening one beds down weeping, and in the morning glad song. As for me, I thought in my quiet days, never will I stumble. Lord, in your pleasure you made me stand mountains strong. When you hid your face, I was stricken. To you, O Lord, I call, and to the Master I plead. What profit in my blood, in my going down deathward? Will dust acclaim you? Will it tell your truth? Hear, Lord, and grant me grace. Lord, become helper to me. You have turned my dirge to a dance for me, undone my sackcloth, and bound me with joy. Oh, let my heart hymn you and be not still, Lord my God, for all time I acclaim you. And with all the failures that any honest translator knows that he or she is guilty of, every once in a while you hit a success and you pat yourself on the shoulder. Now the Hebrew has an alliteration, that line about dirge and dance. It's hafachta misbedi lemachol li, where the word for dirge is misped, the word for dance is machol with the alliterated M. So I picked that up with the dance and the dirge, and that made me feel very happy. Now, okay, a very short one, but I think an exquisite psalm in the original. I won't comment on how much of the exquisiteness is captured in my version. Psalm 8. For the lead player on the gitit, a David psalm. Lord our Master, how majestic your name in all the earth, whose splendor was told over the heavens from the mouth of babes and sucklings. You founded strength on account of your foes to put an end to enemy and avenger. When I see your heavens, the work of your fingers, the moon and the stars you fixed firm, what is man that you should note him, and the human creature that you pay him heed, and you make him little less than the gods, with glory and grandeur you crown him. You make him rule over the work of your hands, all things you set under his feet, sheep and oxen all together, and also the beasts of the field, birds of the heavens and fish of the sea, what moves on the paths of the seas. Lord our Master, how majestic your name in all the earth. And I will conclude this brief opening presentation by reading Psalm 90, which is, I know we will probably get into a little conversation about what the Psalms are. Now, this is a psalm that, if you listen to the words, seems to be a supplication on the part of the community in some time of crisis. But it's much more than that. It's a meditation on the evanescence of human life as against God's eternity, which it casts into very moving poetry. A prayer of Moses, man of God. O Master, you have been our abode in every generation. Before mountains were born, before you spawned earth and world, from forever to forever, you are God. You bring man back to the dust and say, turn back, humankind. For 1,000 years in your eyes are like yesterday gone, like a watch in the night. You engulf them with sleep. In the morn they are like grass that passes. In the morning it sprouts and passes. By evening it withers and dies. For we are consumed in your wrath, and in your fury we are dismayed. You have set our transgressions before you, our hidden faults in the light of your face. For all our days slip away in your anger. We consume our years like a sigh. The days of our years are but 70 years, and if in great strength, 80 years, and their pride is trouble and grief. For swiftly cut down, we fly off. Who can know the strength of your wrath, as the fear of you is your anger? To count our days rightly, instruct, that we may get a heart of wisdom. Come back, O Lord, how long, and have pity on your servants. Sate us in the morn with your kindness. Let us sing and rejoice all our days. Give us joy as the days you afflicted us, the years we saw evil. Let your acts be seen by your servants and your glory by their children. And may the sweetness of the Master our God be upon us, and the work of our hands firmly found for us, and the work of our hands firmly found. Thank you, and now we will talk.
Thanks for offering that presentation. I want to open up. What we're going to do is sort of have a conversation. I'm going to ask some questions, but I'm hoping that it'll turn into more of a free-form event fairly shortly. And then after about 40 minutes or so, we'll turn it over to questions from the audience. But I wanted to start just, Professor Alter, by asking you, it seems to me, both from reading the book and from listening to what you're saying, that there's a process of stripping away ornament that that there's been over the course of several thousand years, particularly in terms of the King James Version, that there's been a lot of ornament that's attached attached to the Psalms, and that a fundamental purpose of the translation is to strip away ornament and return to a translation that mirrors the original text. I wanted to ask, start the conversation by asking you about that as an intention, to comment on that a little bit, and then also sort of why does that bring us? Is it just simply a matter of bringing us closer to the original text? And if so, what's the value in that, or is there some other purpose attached to it?
Okay, that's a good and complicated double-barreled question. I think it's a fair description of at least 50% of my aims as a translator of this kind of poetry. Biblical Hebrew is very dignified, and as the poetry, not so much the prose, can have a kind of loftiness to it, but at the same time, it's rather homespun and very concrete. And I do think that the King James Version, which even you see the traces of the King James Version, even in translations that try to throw it out entirely, like the New English Bible or the New Jewish Publication Society translation, there is this overlay of sometimes heavily theological language or sometimes highfalutin language as well, and of abstractions. And I have tried to strip all this away. Now, what difference does this make? I guess in a way, I hadn't thought of this to begin with, but what I'm trying to do in Bible translation in general, but particularly with Psalms, is roughly analogous, perhaps I shouldn't push the analogy too far, between what Latimer did with his translations of Homer back in the 1950s, which is, as you're saying, to strip away the veneer of all those Victorian translations of Homer and to get back at the archaic earthiness of Homer's Greek. Now, why would one want to do that? Because I think that we, not only as certainly as readers of poetry, but I would also say that those who use Psalms for their own devotional purposes are entitled to have more access to the worldview and the feel and weight of the words of this set of ancient Hebrew texts that were composed, after all, in the early Iron Age.
Jonathan, do you want to jump in? I mean, yeah. One of the things that interests me about this is this whole notion of biblical history and of actually looking at these texts as historic, and I want to talk a little later as well about them as literary documents and not simply as, or simply is probably the wrong word, but not only as spiritual documents.
Sure. First of all, I would like to stand on a point of personal privilege before I weigh in. I've written 6 books on history of texts, scriptural texts, and the publication of those books have afforded me some wonderful experiences in life. And I have to say that one of the peak experiences is to be on this stage with Robert Alter, who is a giant of biblical scholarship, one of the greats, one of the immortals. And truly so. I recall, you know, the first book I wrote was called The Harlot by the Side of the Road, which refers to Genesis 38, and the first time the scales fell from my eyes about the meaning of that text was when I read a selection from The Art of Biblical Narrative, Professor Alter's book. I believe it was excerpted in commentary, and
That's
I believe
right.
I read it when I was still in high school. So in a sense, I owe to that moment, that epiphany, a whole writing career, so to speak. So I just want to acknowledge this personal debt. I have had occasion to quote Professor Alter in virtually every one of my books, including a book about the book of Revelation, which is far afield from the Jewish scriptures. But you're in this book and in every book that I've written. To get to your question, David, I'm sorry. I just felt respect must be paid. One of the things that is so difficult in talking about the Bible is that we take the Bible as we find it, and we find it as a work attributed to divine authorship and a work weighted with tremendous spiritual significance, and it makes it so hard for people to see that it is self-evidently the work of human authorship and of multiple human authorship. Mm-hmm. And in the preface to Professor Alter's new translation, he makes this point. By tradition, the Psalms were authored by King David, the sweet singer of Israel, and this is a cherished idea that a lot of people still hold because they learned it in Sunday school and Bible class, and they can't entertain.
Cherished by none more than writers named David, I think.
Exactly. and in fact, it was not and could not have been written by the historical David if there was a historical David, which is yet another question that a lot of people who don't approach the academic scholarship, secular academic scholarship, can't really encounter. It's an idea that's so alien to them. What we see in the act of translation is that there are fingerprints on these texts, and they are fingerprints of mortal human beings, and there are mortal human beings whose lives and what they knew, what they thought, what they did can be discerned beneath the surface of the text. One thing the Bible very rarely is a historical document. It's a document that can be placed into history, and that's the great fascination I have with this field. And it's something that I learned a lot about in reading all of Professor Alter's books. But to say, can we learn about history from the Bible, especially from the Psalms, I think the answer is no. Can we learn about the history of the text, and does that shed light on history as we conventionally think of the world? Well, that's true too.
Well, then let's go back and talk a little bit about the history of the text and how if we can accept that they weren't written by King David, and that King David, as you say, and as Professor Alter says in the preface to the book, may or may not have even existed as a historical figure. What is the genesis of this form? What were they originally? How did Psalms evolve? What were they originally used for? One of the most interesting sort of details in the preface of the book has to do with the idea of that it's you talk about that at a certain point there were you presume there were professional psalmists, and that people on their way to make a devotion would stop and have a psalmist would write a psalm for them specific to the occasion. I found that to be fascinating because it really made them come to life to me in a way that I could imagine and understand in terms of, you know, a physical creation, a human creation. But can we go, maybe both of you can go back and talk a little bit about the history of the Psalms, how they evolved as a form in terms of the individual psalm, and how this collection came together or became the kind of definitive collection of Psalms.
Well, the Psalms, of course, are an anthology, a tricky sort of anthology because it's always like those anthologies that Louis Untermeyer used to edit, which span 500 years of English poetry. So these span 500 years or maybe even 600 years of Hebrew poetry, probably the oldest going back to around the time of David, but clearly quite a few from the Second Temple period or from the time of the Babylonian exile. Evidently, many of these poems were composed around the temple precincts, maybe by priests, for liturgical use, either for our hypothetical farmer from the Judean hill country who comes to Jerusalem having recovered from a grave illness, which is what Psalm 30, which I read, is about, and wanting to offer a Thanksgiving sacrifice and wanting to be able to recite or have someone recite for him a Thanksgiving psalm. So he may have found somebody who set up shop, a professional psalm poet in the general vicinity of the temple, who in payment for a 6-month-old kid or whatever give him this nice Thanksgiving psalm. So many of them may have evolved that way. People started making small collections, and there are technical reasons why we can figure this out, of groups of psalms, maybe as early as the late First Temple period. The First Temple is destroyed in 586, and there were originally, evidently, 4 smaller anthologies, which were edited together to make our Book of Psalms, except that one of the books was divided into 2 books, so we could come out with a canonical number of 5, like the 5 books of Moses. And that probably happened sometime in the 5th century BCE. But what interests me is the fact that not all these poems look like they were ever used in the temple ritual. Some of them are very personal, meditative, philosophical, and somehow or other they sneaked their way in, maybe because they were such good poems that the anthologizers couldn't resist the temptation. Jonathan?
I was taken by your attention to the tools, the tool marks of poetry, the use of alliteration, and your struggle as a translator with a poet's ear to preserve that. Now, this says to me that these were real writers in the sense that we understand writers, craftsmen of the word, people who sat down and worried about meter and rhythm and alliteration. Do you agree that that's true?
Absolutely. I mean, some of these poems are just breathtaking examples of the art of poetry. Although, to be perfectly candid, there are also boilerplate psalms.
Right.
and I'll say a few words about that. Let's take the supplication psalm. Now, the idea in writing a psalm is not to be utterly startling and so original that you'll confuse the audience, which is an audience of worshipers. So in the supplication psalm, you have to say, grant me grace, O Lord, have mercy on me, because I am sorely bestricken, and so forth. Now, some psalms actually make very good poetry out of those formulas. They somehow breathe a breath of freshness into them. But then there are others, when you read them, and you say, I've heard this about 15 times already as I've read through Psalms. So that's one problem. Then one thing which I didn't notice carefully enough until I actually had to sit down in a translation for the act of translation, there are 9 alphabetic acrostics in the Book of Psalms. One of them has, most typically, there's 1 line of poetry for each of the 22 letters of the Hebrew alphabet, or some of them lack 1 or 2 of the letters. There's 1 psalm, Psalm 121, that has 8 lines of poetry for each of the 22 letters. So it goes on forever. It's the longest chapter in the Bible, and also I think one of the most tedious. One gets a suspicion with these alphabetic acrostics that they were kind of exercises. And One recent scholar has proposed that they were practice exercises for the priestly scribes to work out the alphabet. They're not necessarily inspiring poetry. So there's that too in the collection.
And there's also, I guess, what you refer to as anti-psalms, or psalms that play against, in the same sense that there are boilerplate psalms, there are also psalms that play against type that are almost, we could almost call them experimental psalms.
Right. For example, one very familiar one, Psalm 137, which in my translation begins by Babylon's streams, but the King James Version by the waters of Babylon, is a psalm about the that expresses the refusal to sing psalms. How can we sing the songs of the Lord on foreign soil and so forth? So that shows you how far the concept of psalm could be pushed.
I have a question that applies to both of you. On the one hand, in terms of translation, on the other hand, in terms of history, it comes back to what you were just saying about how there were things that you didn't realize until you began to translate, and it has to do with the sort of interior journey you take, either as a translator or as a historian studying a text, a familiar text, even probably actually more so a familiar text, that closely, how it changes your perception of the text, how it changes your appreciation of the text. And I throw it out to both of you to sort of, as a jump ball.
Okay, I'll speak briefly.
I'll defer to
that. I guess there were two things that I discovered. One is how at many points the original poems are breathtakingly concrete and physical in ways that hadn't quite dawned on me before. For example, there's one line of poetry that my translation reads, I may be forgetting or substituting one word for another. It's approximately like this. Our neck was bowed to the ground, our belly clung to the earth. Now, the King James Version says our soul bowed down to the ground. But the Hebrew word nefesh does not mean soul. It means life breath, but it also means neck or throat, which is the passage through which the life breath passes. And the image there seems to me clearly an image of somebody flat on his belly, and the word belly is unambiguous. The new JPS translated is our body. I guess that they felt that belly was not decorous enough. Somebody's flat on his stomach on the ground, and an enemy is stomping him on his back. And that was strong for me, and I hadn't realized it before. The other element that struck me as a translator, a kind of discovery, and I think, Jonathan, you will appreciate this, was how vivid some of the survivals of pagan imagination were in many of the psalms. For example, I think it's Psalm 80, sometimes I forget the numbers, begins like this. The Hebrew is Elohim nitzav ba'adat el bekerev Elohim yishpot, which I concluded after a little reflection had to be translated. God takes his stand in the divine council. Among the gods he judges. Now, some of you may say, well, what are the gods doing in the Holy Book of Psalms, which is part of our monotheistic Bible? But in fact, there are all sorts of survivals of pagan mythology in these poems. And this seems to be a poem in which there is a divine council, a council of the gods, of the sort that's roughly like what you find in Homer. And our God, the supreme God, stands in judgment over all the rest. And actually, in a wonderful twist in this particular psalm, God says, hey, I thought you guys were gods, but you're not doing your job, because I look, you're supposed to be administering justice on earth, and I see injustice everywhere. So you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to demote you from your divinity. And at the end of it, he says, I thought you were gods, and the sons of the Most High you all were. Now you will die like men. It's an amazing idea, Jonathan.
Well, I noticed that you rendered a very familiar line from the psalm that you presented, that God made man a little lower than, it's usually translated as a little lower than the angels,
right.
And you rendered it as a little lower than the gods.
Right.
Is the original Hebrew Elim?
No, the original is Elohim.
So it's even more
ambiguous. Yeah, right. Previous translators have either gotten very nervous about this sort of thing, or they imagine that the God of the Hebrew Bible is the God of Aquinas and the God of Maimonides, which is very far from the case. So the word Elohim, as far as I know, never means angels. If you say it's an ellipsis for B'nai Elohim, the sons of gods, well, even they aren't quite angels. They're some kind of divine beings, as you see in the first chapter of Job. So I figured, well, I could bite the bullet and I say little less than the gods.
Well, I would like to, if I could, confront you with the question that I'm often asked, and it's a very uncomfortable question to answer. By preface to this question, I want to point out, you mentioned that you had the chutzpah to translate Psalms, but I would say, having had the chutzpah to translate the Torah, all five books of Moses, the Psalms must have been a little easier.
Cake, right.
You have also translated very powerfully the biographical narrative of King David,
right.
Which for me is the most compelling and the most absorbing and the most challenging narrative in the Bible.
I agree.
It's like a Sopranos plot, and right. It probably was a Soprano.
Only better. Yeah.
But the question that I'm leading up to is, David has a very remote relationship with the personified God of Genesis, never is granted the opportunity to see him, never is granted the opportunity to speak to him, and this vexes him terribly. And at a certain moment, which I found to be a defining moment of biblical narrative, when the child he fathered through his adulterous relationship with Bathsheba dies, he says, no amount of prayer is going to bring this child back. I shall not, the child will not come to me, but I will go to him.
Exactly.
And,
yeah.
And that, to me, bespoke a certain fatalism, a certain cynicism, and a certain worldliness. And so the question that I'm pointing to is, do you have any kind of challenge to your faith, to your concept of a supernatural, personified, anthropomorphic God directing the fate of humankind, knowing what you know as a scholar of the Bible?
Well, I think the only way to... You're right, this is the kind of question that makes you uncomfortable. Thank you.
And yet it's an interesting question.
Right. But I think the only way to answer such a question, not only privately, but I believe publicly, is absolute candor. So I would say that for a long time, I have not really been able to believe in the kind of God that most of the biblical writers believed in. That is, one who reveals himself explicitly to human beings, who is personally concerned with both the fate of individuals and the fate of nations. I mean... I come down closer to the Job poet than any other biblical writer. That is, if there were such a God, then where was he between 1939 and 1945, or where is he when all the dear ones that probably everybody in this room has, who certainly weren't sinners or evil people, are stricken down with terrible diseases at an early age. So now this confronts me then with a problem when I'm translating the Psalms, since most of the psalmists, unlike the Job poet really is debating with Psalms among other biblical writers, that most of the psalmists do believe in such a God. That is, you have lines in Psalms, and many, many of them, which express a kind of moral calculus. If you're good, it pays. If you're bad, you get yours. As in I was a lad, and I've also grown old, and I have never saw I've never seen a righteous man in need or his seed seeking bread. So, I mean, if you really believe that, then you walk down a main street in any of our American cities and see wretched homeless people on the street, and you say they all must have lived evil lives. And I can't even begin to imagine such a thing or such a God. So when I'm translating that kind of line, I guess I have to invoke Coleridge's willing suspension of disbelief. I don't believe it, but I have to convey what the psalmists believe.
Well, doesn't this, and this is also for both of you, doesn't this bring up an issue that has to do with cultural sophistication in some way, at the risk of sounding like a liberal humanist? Wow. That although the Psalms as poetry may be aesthetically sophisticated, they were written in a culture where religious law was law. I mean, these were prescriptions for living, so that in my layman's reading of this is that they're not, that in the context of their time, they are stories that people used for very practical, we're not necessarily talking about the Psalms now, but even biblical stories, for very practical reasons. How do we live? In a way that religion or religious writings or spiritual texts are not in Western secular society used that way anymore. Now we have civil laws that we use. These had a civil function as well as a spiritual function. Am I completely off base by throwing this idea out?
Well, first of all, it's a complex answer precisely because there are so many authors at work in the Bible,
right, that's a good
and so
point.
Many value systems.
Right.
And the passages in David, in Samuel, that I've referred to, I would argue, and I'm not the only one who's argued this, the psalm that Professor Alter quoted, a little lower than the gods, has been characterized as an expression of Davidic humanism, of a biblical humanism. In other words, it makes man the measure of all things. And so I would say that there, and this is what I find very exciting about the Bible, is that it is not just a stick to beat people with until they behave the way priests, rabbis, and ministers want them to behave. It has a compassion and an insight into how human beings really behave and looks for ways of exalting what human beings really are. And there are other voices, yet other voices, the classical prophets, who implore us to feed the hungry and clothe the naked and make that the measure of all things. But I want to go back to something Professor Alter said, which is there is an outlook, a worldview that's expressed in the Bible and is expressed tragically right now. Right here and now, of Jews who, if you ask them, where was God between 1939 and 1945, they will say, and I'm not making this up, God was in the gas chambers at Auschwitz saying to the Jews, this is what happens to you when you forsake me. And that morality,
well, there are people who say that.
And that morality comes from Deuteronomy. That if you read Deuteronomy,
I agree with that.
The author of Deuteronomy said, if you forsake the covenant, these terrible things will happen to you, and they will not be authored by the devil, by Satan, who doesn't exist in Jewish theology. It'll be authored by God. And that's why these texts can be so dangerous and so hateful. They have their exalting moments, but they also have their heartbreaking moments.
Yeah, I'm very much in the same ballpark with you on this. That is, the one thing I think we have to be careful about is, and certainly Jonathan Kirsch, in what he just said, is perfectly careful, is condescending to the Bible because it's an ancient text and we've advanced and we're much more sophisticated and so forth. The Bible, as you said, is not one whole cloth, and there are many aspects of it which, for various reasons, and I don't want to simply invoke the Shoah as the only reason, but for various reasons, we may find objectionable or unacceptable. But these were, and some of those ideas, like the, perhaps ideas about causation in history, which you have in Deuteronomy, as you quite rightly say, have to do with ancient Near Eastern assumptions about the world. On the other hand, these were not naive or unsophisticated people. And poems like Psalm 90, which I read, this meditation on the ephemerality of human life and over against God's eternity are breathtaking, and I think still speak to us, and they don't come from a naive writer.
Well, this brings me back to the question of translation, because this is the fourth yeah. book of translation that you've done. And I'm curious about the impetus, again, this sort of brings us back to where we started, but I'm curious about the impetus to translate the particular text that you've translated, the way in which you chose to, you know, if there's been a kind of process, I was going to start here and work my way through this, or if it's been more of a kind of serendipitous thing, and how much it has to do with that appreciation of this kind of complexity and sophistication, and in many ways, ambiguity and contradiction.
Well, my career as a translator started by accident. That I had a conversation with the man who since has become my very much appreciated editor at Norton, Steve Foreman. And he had an idea for me to do a certain project involving the book of Genesis in a series called Norton Critical Editions that some of you may be familiar with. And as I listened, I said, yeah, that's a good idea, but you know, there's something really wrong with all the translations. And if I were to do this, I'd have to do my own translation. You got to watch what you say.
Yeah.
So I ended up not doing a Norton Critical Edition, but a translation of Genesis, which I was delighted to do because it's just a wonderful book. It has all kinds of fantastic things in it, including the great competitor for the most magnificent piece of narrative in the Bible to the David story, which is the Jacob-Joseph story. Then I thought, since that went much better than I thought it was going to go, I then thinking exactly like Jonathan Kirsch, I said, what do I most love of all the narratives of the Bible? It's the story of David. So I ended up doing that. And then I had another conversation with Steve Foreman, who's a dangerous man to have a conversation with. And he said, well, what would you like to do next? I said something about putting together a few small books of the Bible that I loved, like Esther and Ruth and Ecclesiastes, and he looked very unenthusiastic. And he said, that's a nice idea, he said, but there's not much market for miscellaneous books of the Bible. So I said, well, what do you have in mind? He said, well, you know, if we had our druthers, we'd like you to do the whole Hebrew Bible. I said, oh, please give me a break. So he said, then why not the whole five books of Moses? And even though that did involve, for me as a translator, it was the wasteland of Leviticus and parts of Numbers, I decided after some thought that it was worth tackling. And I was glad that I did it because it is a kind of fundamental, foundational text of all of biblical literature. And then I discovered, I hadn't quite calculated this way, but my editor was smarter than I was, that because it's that kind of text, it brought the attention to what I was doing as a translator of the Bible to a different level. And then my move to Psalms was, okay, I've done that. I would really like to do something which is entirely poetry.
And the question, though, and this, again, I throw out to both of you, is that by translating books of the Bible, you're explicitly interpreting or saying that the Bible is an interpreted text, not necessarily a literal text. This comes back to kind of how the Bible gets used, either positively or negatively. Mm-hmm. And yet we're in a culture now, as we have always been, where there are large groups of people who take the Bible as literal truth. I wonder, has it opened you up to any kind of, what kind of criticism or what kind of counter-arguments has it opened up, the idea that the Bible can be retranslated, the Bible can be reinterpreted, the Bible can be essentially rewritten or redefined? What is that, both positive and negative, what does that open up?
Okay, well, I'll respond first because it's really directed to the Translators Project. On the whole, I think the reaction of a broad spectrum of readers in these days because of email, you get very direct feedback. So the reaction of a broad spectrum of readers has been quite sympathetic, but I've gotten a couple of really riveting counter statements. My favorite being, I told this to somebody this afternoon, a very short email I got from somebody which read like this. I've committed it to memory. It said, Professor, I am appalled at your arrogance for translating the Bible. There is only one guide to translating the Bible, and that's Jesus Christ our Lord. So that person obviously felt that the King James Version, I would assume, was dictated by the divine spirit or by Jesus Christ, and no one should mess with it. For me, what has been most deeply instructive in translating the Bible is to see how uncertain many of the meanings are. I mean, meanings of sentence units, meanings of particular terms. So when people talk about biblical truth, this country has to live by biblical values, I, as someone who's worked very closely, word by word, with the biblical text, say, what do biblical values mean? It's really not that certain what they are.
Well, this is one of the great ironies and afflictions of the Bible, is that there are a great many people in the United States of America who I'm sure think that the King James is the original version of the Bible and don't have access to the Greek, the Latin translation by Jerome, or the Greek, or the original Hebrew. One of the great leaps forward in Western civilization is that we were unshackled from the original languages and the original text, and we were given the freedom to translate and read various versions of the Bible. The Catholic Church was burning people alive for the sin of translation in the Middle Ages, and we moved beyond that. There are other great world religions that still do not afford that freedom of thought and that freedom of expression of the text. It's very important to our democracy and to our civilization. I mean that in the gravest possible way. We live in a time where we see the price of that narrowness and rigidity in religion, that we have the freedom to ask these questions. And of course, the great irony is that a man like Professor Alter can get closer to the original meanings of this text held to be divine than the people who hold it to be divine, because they're working from an Elizabethan translation.
Well, we could go on for a while, but I feel like we should turn it over to some questions from the audience. We have some time for that, and then there'll be a book signing afterwards outside. So we'll take questions until I get the high sign that we can't take anymore, and then we'll adjourn out into the entry area. So there's a wait for the microphone to come around.
One comment and one question. First, I think there are many psalms in the Bible that are not necessarily presenting only the view that God will take care of you if you're good and not if you're evil. For example, Psalm 89, you have a tremendous lament by the author that the Davidic dynasty, which was promised to last forever, has fallen apart. You know, so there's an enormous concern there about God has not come through with the promise in that particular case. That's just a comment. The other thing I wanted to ask was what do you think, it seems to me that part of the power of Psalms is that there's a lot of interest in the personal struggle, or at least it's portrayed as personal, even though, as mm-hmm. you say, it might be written by professional psalmists. And do you think that is unique, or not perfectly unique, perhaps, but rare in ancient literature?
Okay. First, about your comment, of course, you're right that there are a number of psalms directed to moments of historical disaster, whether it's the destruction of the kingdom of Judea in 586 or other disasters that we can't quite identify, which are torn with anguish over God. You know, you promised us in a covenant that you would stand by your anointed king and your people, and look what's happened to us. I think on the personal level, I can't think of any psalm that questions this moral calculus. Generally, what the tact that's taken is, if you see evil people prospering, it's illusory. It's not going to last, and something's going to happen, which doesn't seem to me an altogether satisfactory answer to the problem. Okay. As far as I know now, except for Aramaic, I don't read the other ancient Near Eastern languages. I don't read Akkadian or Egyptian, so I'm dependent on translation. But most psalm-like compositions were common in the ancient Near East. And in fact, there are at least three or four psalms that in our collection that have so many lines that are close to, for example, a hymn to the sun god in Egyptian, that many scholars think that they're kind of monotheistic adaptations of that. But this intensely personal note, I think, is probably distinctive of ancient Israel.
I'd just like to add, and I think it's part of the importance of the text, is that the Book of Psalms is one of the few books of the Bible that is actually used in our contemporary life. Another one is the Book of Revelation, used for some pretty weird purposes.
Yes.
But even the Psalms that you chose to present are going to be deeply familiar to anyone who attended a funeral, and of course it's going to penetrate to a very vulnerable place in your heart, because you hear it and recite it at that moment in life, and that's one of the things that makes the Book of Psalms so enduring, in a way that other texts are entirely forgotten.
This is a question for Professor Alter. I was wondering, in your process of translation, if you noticed among the books a theme holding together the Psalms, or if they were just haphazardly put together, or did you notice that some of the Psalms were linked together by words being repeated or alliterated?
You mean interconnections among the Psalms?
Yes.
This is something I think you can tell in translation. You don't even have to be a Hebrew scholar. There are groups of Psalms, like two famous groups are the Hallelujah Psalms, which are the last half dozen or so in the collection, and then the Psalms that have the superscription Songs of Ascents. And they not only are grouped according to category, but they sound many of the same themes. And some, not necessarily in a repetitious way. For example, another group of Psalms running from about Psalm 95 to Psalm 99 or 100 are celebrations of God's power over creation with a particular theme of his conquering the primordial sea. And those read really like variations on a theme in a musical composition, so that they dovetail together quite nicely. There is one odd example of a psalm that's been broken in two by the editors, that is Psalm 9 and 10, are an alphabetical acrostic with a couple of the letters missing, but you can tell this an alphabetical acrostic, and it breaks off in the middle, and then there are a few lines that don't make much sense, and then the acrostic picks up. For some reason, the ancient editors decided they were two separate psalms, and that's why it came out.
Well, I have a question about the word psalm with that missing P and L in English. So where does that come from, and is it a word that always was associated with this particular set of poems? What's the original Hebrew for the word psalm? And how else what other words in English have any relationship to psalm?
Okay, that's a good question. Now, the very first translation done of the Hebrew Bible was done in Alexandria in the 3rd century. It's called the Septuagint. And it was done because the Jews living in Egypt mostly didn't know Hebrew anymore. And they needed, they were Greek speakers, and they needed a Greek translation in order to be able to read the Bible. The Greek word psalmos means something like song, and that's how it came to be the title. Now, the Hebrew word for psalm is mizmor, which also comes from a root that means to sing, and I often translate it when it's a verb as to hymn, H-Y-M-N. But that's not what the collection is called in Hebrew, paradoxically. In Hebrew, the collection is called Tehillim, which is the rabbinic plural of the biblical word Tehillah, which means praise. So in Hebrew, it's actually not called songs, but praises. Praises are probably the second most populous genre of psalms, the first one being supplication, but evidently the ancient editors wanted to frame the whole as being praise and celebration of God's grandeur, and that's why the Hallelujah Psalms are put at the end.
That your reading in original Hebrew and then also your translation was marvelous, and thank you. Now, there is a private collection of English Bible as well as Hebrew, Aramaic, Coptic, right here downtown LA. And I would like to extend an invitation. You know, sometime you come in and to take a look at it.
Okay, thank you.
That gentleman, I was originally, that gentleman in the back right there.
There's other poetry in the Bible. How does the poetry of Psalms compare to some of the other poems?
That's actually a very good question. I would say, I'm going to put to one side the Song of Songs, which is very late and is our only extended example of love poetry, and I think it's rather different in a number of ways from the other. But the two big sites of poetry outside of Psalms in the Bible are the prophets and the book of Job. And I would say that the poetry of Psalms tends, by and large, to be more traditional, to use a set repertoire of images and to go through certain familiar moves, although it does it at times with great eloquence and power. Whereas the Job poet, for example, will use utterly startling and unanticipated imagery. So that's the chief difference. As far as the formal organization of the poetry, the way it scans and the way the line is structured, it's really not different from the other places where poetry is in the Bible.
Thank you. This is for Professor Alter. I was curious if in the Hebrew, does it specify among pronouns a gender specification? And then also in your interpretation, did you choose to make how did you translate gender pronouns, either in reference to humans or in reference to God?
Okay. Now, I can see that for certain purposes of public worship in kind of staunchly egalitarian congregations, and I actually belong to one such in Berkeley, that it might make sense to try to get a translation which is totally gender neutral in one way or another. But alas, Biblical Hebrew is not at all gender neutral. That is, every verb form, which is not, say, true in Romance languages, every personal pronoun, like you, has both a feminine and a masculine form, and the verb forms, you can tell immediately whether it's masculine or feminine. And it seemed to me to be wrong in terms of trying to convey what this poetry sounds like in the original to eliminate the dimension of gender. The one exception, which whenever I could do and make the line more or less scan, I did, is we have this word Adam, which means, I think when I translated Genesis, I decided it meant human or human creature, because we have this verse, male and female, he created them. In the image of God, he created the Adam. So if the Adam is both male and female, the Adam goes both ways as far as gender. So you might have heard in my translation of Psalm 8, when I came to the word Ben Adam, even though Ben is masculine, I translated it as the human creature. That was the only move I made in the direction of gender equality, because I thought it was justified by the Hebrew term.
right there. Thank you. Wait for the mic.
Good evening. Thank you. I applaud the immediacy and the materiality of the translation that you're attempting. Introduce myself. My name is Eitan Ginsburg. Hi. I'm both a student and occasional teacher of Jewish history. A colleague of mine once helped me understand the term vanity by describing a lashav, in vain, as the heat that comes off your breath.
Exactly.
That yeah. disappears. And it was such a revelation to me right. to use that term to understand the ephemerality of it, as opposed to what we use in English, which has a sense of being concerned with beauty and appearance. But I guess my question is, in your translation, were you aiming, or maybe not aiming, but do you aspire towards a translation that's for our age or for the ages? And I'm looking to the work that you're doing and other modern translators, Robert Fox, for example, of getting to that immediacy of the language and reclaiming the text from King James, which has great longevity and power, which certainly was a translation for the ages.
Okay. By the way, this term hevel, breath or vapor, comes up a number of times in Psalms, and I try to preserve the concrete. For example, ach hevel kol ha'adam, mere breath is, the human being is mere breath. Now, I think it's pretentious, or maybe self-deluding, or both, yes, to say, okay, this is a translation for the ages. My first intention when I started Genesis was just to try to get a literary English that read more or less plausibly as literary English, occasionally maybe a little bit strange, but on the whole, plausibly as literary English, which would mirror many of the stylistic features of the Hebrew. And I wasn't sure how it was going to play out, to be perfectly honest. Now, I've gotten such encouraging responses from readers, including some readers whom, as poets or critics, I have been in awe of for many years, that I'm beginning to think, well, maybe this translation will be around for a little while, but I won't venture to specify how long.
Right.
This is kind of along the lines of your question. A teacher of mine once said that biblical study, and perhaps Judaism itself, is based upon creative misinterpretation. So how did you deal with the ambiguity of the Hebrew? Did you look to other translations? Did you look to rabbinical commentaries? Or did you just go with your own gut?
Well, not with my own gut. I think you have to translate with your head and not your gut. I definitely did not look to other translations. My practice as a translator is not to look at any translations when I'm doing my draft. And then I will glance at some others. And very occasionally, on the level of single word choice, but this is usually not a matter of accuracy, but a matter of felicity, I'll say, oh, you know, they had a better idea than I did. I'll go with that option. I did use commentaries, both modern and the classical Hebrew translators, commentaries both from late antiquity and the Middle Ages, and sometimes they were helpful. And then my greatest single guide, at least to understanding nuances of words on the single word level, was concordance to the Hebrew Bible in Hebrew. In other words, I look at a word and I said, well, for example, in translating the David story, there's this fascinating episode of the rape of Tamar by her half-brother, Amnon. She's asked to prepare him this food, which is called in Hebrew birya. And all the translations translate it as food. And I thought, but that's not right, because we have two other good words in biblical Hebrew for food, ochel, and then lechem, which means bread, but can also mean food by extension. And so I ran through the concordance, all the occurrences, which aren't that many, of birya and the related noun, the verb that comes from it. They all have to do with the kind of food you give to somebody who is either ill or fasting to sustain him. And so I decided on nourishment. And that's the kind of activity that and it's fun. It's like detective work.
I think we're going to wrap it up there. I want to thank Jonathan Kirsch and Robert Alter for a fascinating evening.
Aloud Audio is presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles and made possible through the generosity of the law firm Arendt Fox. Additional support is provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, City National Bank, KPMG, contributors to the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, and Donna and Martin J. Wolf. Media support provided by KCRW 89.9 FM, KUSC 91.5 FM, and KCET.